I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. So-called sanctuary cities like Philadelphia get a lot of attention for limiting cooperation between their local criminal justice systems and federal immigration enforcement. But across Pennsylvania, many law enforcement agencies want to work more closely with ICE to identify and deport immigrants in the country illegally. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports on what's driving these collaborations and the risks they run.
In 2009, the Bensalem Police Department arrested a guy for shoplifting more than $300 of merchandise from a Kohl's department store. A crime that would usually result in a fine or short jail sentence instead opened the door to something else, says Public Safety Director Fred Heron.
And we found during the course of the arrest that he was in the country undocumented, whatever the politically correct term is at the moment. And we had called ICE just to see if they were interested, and they were.
Heron's officers processed the man and then, in his words, turned him over to ICE.
And it was at that point we realized that there's a partnership that could be had to help get criminals off the street.
Heron sits in his office at Bensalem Police Headquarters, where he's worked for more than 30 years. Since he started working here, Bensalem has changed from a mostly white suburb to a township where one out of every five people was born outside the U.S. Today, he's traded in his police uniform for a suit and red tie. Heron says after working with ICE for a few years, that partnership died down around 2012. Then last year, his phone rang.
We get a call about 2-3 weeks after President Trump is inaugurated that, hey, ICE basically saying we're back in business. Are you still interested in 287G? And I said, yeah, I'm very interested.
Staying in the United States without a visa or entering without the approval of a border agent breaks federal immigration law. Enforcing those laws usually falls to the federal government, the same way that the IRS goes after people who don't pay their taxes. 287G agreements are a way for ICE to give some of its powers to local police departments. And the agency wants to work with local law enforcement because it means they can get more done. Last year, ICE called other police chiefs, too, like Jim Donnelly with the Warminster Township Police.
It's a tool. Am I going to turn down a tool that's going to help protect some young victim or some victim in general? No.
According to public records, more than a dozen county jails, sheriff's offices, and police departments across Pennsylvania told ICE they'd be interested in learning more about 287G last year. If they join the program, officers on their police forces will be able to start interviewing people about their immigration status and putting them into deportation proceedings. So far, no 287G agreements exist in Pennsylvania, but some places aren't waiting for this type of contract.
Some departments have increased their cooperation with ICE.
Tom Gross heads up the Pennsylvania Association of Chiefs of Police and used to be the police superintendent in York. He says with immigration enforcement picking up under Trump, local police may just be following orders.
Some of the decision-making comes from their elected body. You know, some elected officials, mayor, council, whoever's overseeing the chief says, we want to be aggressive with illegal immigrants.
Critics of these kinds of partnerships say they lead to abuses of power at the local level and make police departments vulnerable to lawsuits. Gulnaz Fakimi is with the ACLU of Pennsylvania. She says one issue is that turning someone over to ICE because they look like they could have been born in another country is illegal.
To speak very clearly and plainly, what we're talking about here is racial profiling. So there are a number of examples from around the country where this is exactly what happened in the wake of 287G agreements.
She's also concerned about a chilling effect that victims or witnesses of crimes may not cooperate with local police if they fear their loved ones could be deported. Lorena Ayala from Levittown is a U.S. citizen, but not everyone in her family is. She spoke at a recent Bensalem Township Council meeting where more than 150 people came to protest ramping up cooperation with ICE.
I have seen many of my friends and loved ones arrested unjustly. But my hope has always been that the law enforcement will continue to protect us and will continue to do the right thing.
She told me later that her uncle ended up in ICE custody after being stopped by police for rolling through a stop sign. Fear now keeps some of her family members from going out. And it's stories like hers that give Warminster Police Chief Jim Donnelly pause about whether or not partnering with ICE is a good idea.
I would have to vet that through all my stakeholders, meaning my Board of Supervisors, my community, my department, people that are all going to be involved in what's going on.
He says even if he wants to help ICE more, with limited manpower, it might just make more sense for his officers to stick to what they're already doing, enforcing traffic laws and solving local crimes. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Much of Philadelphia's extensive history is hidden from view because the only record of it exists below ground. That may change thanks to a new map that's just gone online today. And for that, I'm joined by Doug Mooney, president of the Philadelphia Archaeological Forum. Mr. Mooney, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
It's a pleasure to be here.
How does something as large as a cemetery get lost?
Well, there are lots of different ways that that can happen. In some cases, a congregation will just no longer be able to care for the cemetery. The members of that congregation move on or die. People forget about it. And slowly it just becomes covered over with weeds and other things and gets forgotten and then is just built on top of. In other cases, probably more common thing is that the congregation located in Center City, say, in the 19th century, wanted to move out to the suburbs where they could expand and made a genuine effort to relocate their cemetery at the time. And it's just a situation where not all of the bodies were removed and some were left behind.
How often can those bodies be identified?
Most of the cemeteries we're talking are unmarked, so there are no longer headstones. A lot of these churches never maintained or have lost any kind of a plot map that would have indicated who was buried where. So in a lot of cases, it's just not possible to identify specifically who an individual was unless, in some cases, they may have been buried with a lid plaque, which identified their name and dates of death and birth and whatnot on the coffin lid. And if that's preserved sufficiently well, you can still read that.
Are there more cemeteries to be discovered potentially, or at this point, with the amount of work that's been done, that's not likely?
No, absolutely. There's still there's a tremendous number of those 208 mapped cemeteries on our database. You know, there's a large number of those that potentially still contain human remains. We're working right now with a project out in West Philadelphia on Chestnut Street in West Philadelphia, where it was brought to our attention just a couple of weeks ago that there a site that's getting ready to be developed could have a historic cemetery on it. Nobody knew much about it, and we did some research, and we now know that that was known as the Harmonia Burial Ground and may be the oldest African-American cemetery in West Philadelphia, dating to 1826.
Is the work you do considered a race against time in terms of if so much development takes place, we'll lose the opportunity to learn what's underneath?
It can be. It certainly can be. In a lot of instances, especially with these historic cemeteries, you know, we do what we can to try to identify development projects that might impact one of these cemeteries, but there's no way for us to keep track of all the building that goes on here in Philadelphia. And so in some cases, we don't learn about a particular project in a particular cemetery until it's either just about to go to construction or maybe the work has already started.
So is that a primary goal of the project, to serve as a signal to those who might want to develop, for example, that, hey, before you commit?
I mean, that is the biggest overarching reason why we did this. And really what this map represents is advance warning. And with advance warning, you have options. The worst of all possible circumstances is where a construction project starts up and now all of a sudden you've got burials popping up.
Yeah.
So what we're hoping is that, you know, developers in this case can access our map in some cases even before they purchase a property. So they may say, you know, I might want to develop this particular site, look at our map and say, find out there was a historic cemetery there. And maybe they decide, let's go someplace else. We don't want to deal with it. And these are Philadelphians. They're the people that built this city. We certainly believe that they deserve to be treated respectfully. And we also believe that the city in this case has a legal and moral obligation to ensure that these cemeteries are protected. And if they can't be preserved in place, that they be respectfully relocated to a new location.
Do you have to sell the city on that, or are they on board? And are there other cities that perhaps even have a archaeologist as part of
There are plenty of other states and cities that have accommodated this type of discovery and have passed laws to make sure that remains are treated respectfully. In this particular case, it has been a battle with the city to try to get them to admit that they do have the legal recourse to take charge of these situations. Pennsylvania law makes it crystal clear that they do. It's just a matter of getting people to acknowledge that and then enforcing the laws that already exist.
So for listeners who want to learn more and perhaps interface with the map.
Right. It just went live today. Our website is www.phillyarchaeology.net.
Thanks so much for the work you do, and thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
Doug Mooney is president of the Philadelphia Archaeological Forum. You're listening to NewsWorks tonight on WHYY. February is Black History Month, and many schools mark it with special events and lessons. Reflecting upon her own education and subsequent journalism career, Sophia Bowen wanted to go deeper into Black history, beyond the few well-known American figures who typically are covered. The result is her project entitled Black History Untold, and now in its third year, Bowen invites prominent African Americans, mostly in Philadelphia, to write essays on the figures overlooked in most Black History Month coverage. Sophia Bowen spoke with WHYY's Annette John Hall.
Talk to us a little bit about how the project came about and your ideas for themes for the project.
The project launched in 2016 when I was a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, or Philly.com, as some people may know it. And I just wanted us to cover Black history differently. I found that the way that Black history often was taught in schools was the same way that it was tended to be covered. So when I was growing up in New York, I went to a predominantly Black school, and Black history was so ingrained into the fiber of everything that we did. Like, I just thought that was normal. And it wasn't until I moved to Pennsylvania, up to the Poconos, to a predominantly white school, where I realized that Black history wasn't taught in that same way. And I saw the impact that it had on some of the Black students there. And that's when I really started to kind of clue into the importance of Black history education. So when I started reporting, I realized that the same way that we were teaching it was the same way that we were covering it. It's like, okay, let's cover our three or four main figures, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, maybe Malcolm X, depending on how liberal our school is. You know what I mean? It wasn't showing the nuance, the vibrancy that was in our culture inside of this country and outside of this country. So I said, you know what? One year I want to ask people what they didn't learn in school about Black history, how they learned it, and how it impacts them today. It's going to be an identity series that acknowledges the power of that knowledge, but also a critique on the education system and asking whether or not we're teaching our children really about themselves and their communities. The first year we had about 33 people, all with Philadelphia connections. I had Black Thought, Jesse Williams, Mark Lamont Hill, Jasmine Sullivan, Marley Dias, some incredible people. People will look at it and say, oh, they're really successful, but here they are sharing. These are the things that I learned about my history, and I didn't learn it in school, and it changed the entire trajectory of my life.
So tell me about this year's theme.
This year's future. So this year I asked people, one, what does Blackness in the future look like to you? How do we get there? Three, how does this propel you in your work? And then four, what are some historical figures or present day figures, because right now will become the past, that we should be paying attention to inform that future that you want? So I think there's a saying where they say, you know, you don't know where you're going if you don't know where you've been. And I think that's been the premise for the entire project. This series, this installment, answers both of that. It answers where we've been and where we're also going, or where you see us going. And also Afrofuturism is something that I've always wanted to learn a bit more about. It's literally just imagining what Blackness looks like in the future to you. Afrofuturism is what you make it. And for me, that was very, very important, because so much of our existence, a Black experience in America, has been about survival. It's been about, I don't even know what's going to be what's going to be on the plate for dinner tonight. You know what I mean? I don't know how I'm going to pay next month's bills. Let alone what's going to happen decades from now. I can't even think about generational wealth that's been robbed of us. And just kind of giving people that opportunity to really explore what blackness looks like in the future for them. And I talk to people who, you know, are Afrofuturists and who are fluent on this. And I talk to people who never heard of it.
Tell us a little bit about the stories for this year. Some of the people that you talked to who really resonated with you.
A few I can think of offhand are, you know, Taib Smith. He's an incredible entrepreneur and co-founder of Little Giant Creative and the Hip Hop Institute for Entrepreneurship. And he talked about time travel and how that's something that black people have done. He was like, black people, he said, have always had to kind of think and be hopeful for the future because of the nature of their present. They've always had to kind of aspire to the future and to think about the future, even when there are many efforts to rob that up from them.
Constantly viewing yourself through the white lens of history is something you have to constantly shake yourself out of. The images that are marketed to us every day, rarely black owned, it's a form of intellectual warfare. Optimistically, I would hope that sometime in the future, we will be able to talk about blackness outside of a sense of struggle. As generations pass my own, I hope that we will be able to create from a space of offense as opposed to defense.
Taib's piece definitely stayed with me for that. And he asked this amazing question. He said, you know, I was joking with someone one day and I said, what would Sojourner Truth do with an iPhone? And look at all the incredible work that she's done. Imagine if she had what we had now. And I love that question because it puts a level of onus and responsibility on us right now to do as much as we can with all that we have.
Yeah. So, Sophia Ballin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sophia Ballin spoke with WHYY's Annette John Hall. This weekend, a high school production of the music Les Miserables will be performed in Philadelphia. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the play, which puts guns in the hands of teenagers, takes on extra meaning since last week's school shooting in Florida.
The William Penn Charter School in the East Falls neighborhood of Philadelphia does a musical every year, usually lighter fare, like Beauty and the Beast, Godspell, Hairspray. A year ago, it decided to tackle a more serious show, Les Miserables, because, as director Jessica Bender says, it is the favorite musical of her boss, the head of school.
It's challenging vocally. You have to have strong singers, and you have to have a lot of strong singers. Some shows you can get away with one or two. This is a show where you need about 16.
One day more day to revolution. We will nip it in the bud. We'll be
you need more than good singers to do Les Mis. You have to have guns. You have to have a lot of guns.
We are a Quaker school, so the idea of weaponry in every, you know, in any situation has to be considered. The idea of trying to tell the story, this story in particular, without guns, doesn't necessarily seem like it's going to be telling the story as it should be told.
The iconic scene in Les Mis is a barricade in the streets of Paris where armed students rise up against the monarchy.
Fire!
Jaleel Bivens, who's a junior, plays the rebel leader.
What is this person like dragging these kids into? And I realize it's for a change, but the fact that these kids are still getting gunned down makes me have to think about what I do. Like it's made me less goofy, and I'm a silly person in nature. But it's made me just less goofy, especially in this part of the show. Like I want to nail this. I want to like bring it to life.
Bivens' character dies in the gunfight, as do eight other characters. It's a bloodbath. Foremost on the minds of cast members is the school shooting in Florida. Some students at Penn Charter knew the victims personally, having befriended them at a summer camp last year. Bender, the director, held an impromptu forum with the cast and crew the day after the shooting, giving them time to react to the news.
I decided it would be irresponsible to put them on stage in that situation without being able to deal with their feelings about what happened in Florida, especially where they are talking about essentially losing friends to gun violence.
That session turned into a highly emotional 2 hours of talking, crying, and yelling. Caroline Chavanis, a senior, was there.
I'm frustrated. I'm upset. But my main emotion at this point is anger. The fact that this has happened so much is ridiculous.
In the wake of last week's school shooting, Chavanis says Les Miserables feels different. The stakes are higher now. Songs like Empty Chairs and Empty Tables, which mourn the death of friends, seems more real than ever.
Empty chairs at empty tables, where my friends will meet no more.
Sakia Phillips, who's a sophomore, wants to wield her performance in Les Mis like a hammer, as a means of activism.
I've always wanted to be like a doctor when I get older. But it's like, since no one in politics is doing anything about it, I feel like our generation, like, has to do something, like, it needs to stop. I will, like, go into politics, which I hate so much, and, like, I'm, like, gonna be the president. Sorry, I'm saying like a lot. But it's, like, just makes me upset and frustrated, because they're not doing anything about it.
Les Miserables, the student version, will be performed 3 times this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, at Penn Charter School. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
We're staying in school for our final story this evening. Since 1933, the band and orchestra from Cleveland Heights High School in Ohio have done a spring tour visiting other high school music programs, and this year's trip has brought them to Philadelphia, where they met up with one of their most popular alums. At Philadelphia's Central High School, WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt has the story.
16 years ago, a middle school teacher in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, told band director Brett Baker that a pretty good baritone saxophonist was headed to his high school. After hearing the kids audition, Baker made the rare decision of promoting him straight up to the jazz band.
He was a good musician. He took private lessons. He practiced.
The kid also practiced football, which took him to the University of Cincinnati, and then to the Philadelphia Eagles, and then to the steps of the Art Museum, where he delivered one of the great celebratory speeches in city history.
I'm going to take a second to talk to you about underdogs.
Now, a lot has changed since Eagles center Jason Kelce first joined that jazz band. After all, he hasn't even played the baritone sax in 12 years.
It was a school instrument. I didn't have the money for a baritone sax growing up.
But on Thursday morning, he reunited with his high school band, his high school band director, and the very same baritone sax he once tooted as a student. Kelce played along with both schools' jazz bands. How did he sound after 12 years off?
12 years off.
But that didn't matter to the students, who lined up afterward for pictures and autographs.
Oh my God!
Central freshman Alex McFedrin could not believe his good fortune. Neither could his dad, whom he texted after the performance.
And he just responded with a bunch of emojis that I couldn't understand. It was crazy.
Kelce thanked the students for hosting him and shared lessons he learned as a high school musician. Afterward, one of the Central teachers joked that he was a little nervous handing Kelce the mic after his famously salty speech. But Kelce, ever good-natured, chuckled back and just said, "You gotta know your crowd." Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.